University students in Sydney and Melbourne and elsewhere hit the streets this week protesting against the federal cuts to higher education. It's too early to tell if that's going to have an impact, but the sight of mass protest is something we've not seen for a while. But that work of students, that's just the tip of the non-protesting iceberg. Why is this? Go back to the 19th century, go back to the early 20th century, mass protest as a response to simple economic hardship was angry, ugly, violent and extreme. It was also quite common, an expected consequence of hard policy or market failure. And today? Well, my guest this morning argues that dissent is on the decline. Why? Because free market leaders like the US, like Britain, have invented new strategies for dealing with it. Professor Alasdair Roberts is the Jerome L. Rappaport Professor of Law and Public Policy at Suffolk University Law School. He's the author of The End of Protest, How Free Market Capitalism Learned to Control Dissent. Alasdair, welcome.
Hello.
The protest is not what it was.
Well, as you say, in the long history of the free market economy, we used to take for granted that the economy was a roller coaster. There'd be good times and there'd be terrible slumps. And when there were slumps, there would be protests. There would be strikes, demonstrations, sometimes even riots. And leaders took for granted that was part of the deal of a free market economy.
And the market, however, the free market economy is still a roller coaster. That aspect has not changed.
That's right. So I contrast what I call the first liberal era, which is the era preceding the Second World War, and the second liberal era, which is the era of liberalization that followed Reagan and Thatcher 1980 onward. And so the question I pose is, how could we have reverted to market principles and experienced some of the same sort of roller coaster phenomena, but not that mass unrest that used to typify the downturns?
And when we were talking about mass unrest, those words were quite apt. It was mass and it was very unrestful. There was violence. There was...
That's right. And there were a variety of forms, right? There's strike action. There's demonstrations. And sometimes there's violence as well. And, you know, by the 1930s, there were individuals who were saying that this was so severe that it threatened to destabilize the whole system. This wasn't just an economic problem. This is a question of, can society survive? And indeed, can capitalism survive?
It was a threat. I mean, this is the 19th century Marxist threat of the potential of revolution. This is people on the streets who could subvert order.
And even well-intentioned centrists were basically saying there's something awry with the system here. We can't let the roller coaster keep going because we don't know or we haven't yet acquired the capacity to handle the downturns.
Now, you argue that this is an issue which has been quite systematically addressed.
I don't know if I would say there was a conscious plan over the years, but certainly leaders, every time there's a downturn, start refining their techniques for handling unrest. You know, so one thing they do is they start inventing police forces. Major cities invent police forces not because they want to fight crime at first, but because they want to maintain order in the streets when hard times arrive. And then they start refining their militias, and they start developing techniques for handling riots. Then they start crafting laws that regulate when and where people can protest. They even start redesigning urban space so that it's easier to control masses when they get out on the streets in hard times. So over time, it's an accumulation of techniques for dealing with unrest during economic slumps.
And have we, at this point, refined those techniques, do you think? Is it now a fairly safe quantity?
Well, I think I would argue that in the – so what I was telling you is a story about what happened in the first liberal age. I think I would argue that the same sort of process of invention has gone on in the second liberal age as well. So governments have developed techniques for limiting the capacity of people to mobilize even if they are unhappy. They've also developed better techniques of policing and more rigorous techniques of policing. And they've developed new ways of economic intervention that allow them to take the edges off economic downturns as well.
I mean, it's interesting because there's another discussion going on currently about the growing sense of disparity economically in the world, which people like Thomas Piketty, for example, compare to the 19th and the 18th centuries, saying that we're very – far apart in terms of rich and poor. That, ordinarily, you might expect to lead to a certain amount of unrest and protest.
Well, that's right. Authors like Piketty are suggesting that to some degree what we're seeing are aspects of what we once saw in the Gilded Age. Very high economic inequality, a stagnant middle class, declining economic opportunity for the middle class, and a sense that something is fundamentally is wrong. In fact, if you look at the public opinion polling in the United States, there hasn't been a time in the last decade when a majority of Americans thought the country was heading in the right direction. That's even before the financial crisis. People thought something was wrong. And so then the question is, you know, why don't we see that expressed through unrest as we would have seen in years past? And I think part of the story is that, you know, the mechanisms for allowing people to organize simply aren't there.
Why does that question apply perhaps more to the United States than a lot of other places? I mean, the response to austerity programs in parts of Europe, for example, have met with just the sort of violent, angry outpourings of street protest that you describe, yet that doesn't happen in America.
Well, I think we want to acknowledge a couple of points. First, the economic pain is more severe in countries like Greece and perhaps Portugal and Spain and a few other countries, whereas in the United States, the Federal Reserve was very aggressive in using extraordinary measures, experimental policies to avoid a complete economic collapse.
Printing money, I think they call it.
So, and that's, you know, that's an unusual kind of intervention. It's an intervention by the technocrats, not by the legislative branch. It's the technocrats in the central bank who are doing it. So it's a different kind of crisis response than we saw, let's say, in the 1930s, when it was very much the politicians who were trying to sort out how you respond to crisis. That's part of it. And I think the other difficulty is, you know, even if you've got a mass of unhappy people, they have to sort out how to organize themselves. And so one of the trends we've seen in countries like the US and the UK over the last 30 years is the collapse of the union movement. Today, only about 7% of the private sector workforce in the United States belongs to a union. So you don't have that infrastructure there, that social infrastructure that makes it easier for people to organize. Some people thought that Occupy might be a substitute for the union movement, but that really didn't work out.
Has not technology been something of a substitute? I mean, as we saw in, for example, the Arab Spring, the capacity of social media to act as that organizing agent, why hasn't that worked?
So if we were talking in, let's say, January 2012, and when the Occupy movement is in full blossom, we might very well be saying, well, you know, this is kind of inspirational. Technology has actually allowed a decentralized group of people to organize themselves and express themselves. And, you know, there were some folks who were saying, well, this is going to be the most important progressive movement in decades. But, you know, we rolled the clock out a bit and looked at, say, the one-year anniversary of Occupy. The remarkable thing is how quickly that movement dissipated, because there were real limitations to that mode of mobilization. It was very tough for that movement to articulate goals, to negotiate alliances with other friendly groups, to control militant factions that had the potential to alienate public opinion. So you saw this phenomenon, but it dissipated. There was the movement didn't seem to have the internal capacity to build on its early wins.
I mean, that's something that people said of Occupy, that lack of focus, that lack of what exactly are you protesting about was a key thing in which led people not to understand it, but as you suggest, perhaps undermined its capacity to propel itself.
And, you know, and there's another aspect too. I mean, Occupy is very much like the anti-globalization movement that came into in its own in the late 1990s. And one of the things we did see is that police forces in many major cities basically responded to this new form of organization by upgrading their own capacity to maintain order. So, you know, the picture that's now familiar of police out in the streets in full riot gear with the face guards and the body armor and the shin guards and the whole apparatus, that's a phenomenon of the modern age. If you had looked at public order policing 30 or 40 years ago, you would not have seen police dressed that way or acting with the severity in which they act today.
A horse and a baton might have been as good as you got.
That's right.
Well, and the larger question is sort of interesting, and that goes back to the Occupy point perhaps, that the things that you might protest against are kind of big and nebulous it's about taking on the system, which is a hard thing to sort of make a quick get out onto the streets argument about. It's sort of too big in a way.
Well, you know, Margaret Thatcher had this famous line when she started the market revolution in the UK, and she said, there is no alternative. And maybe that's part of the difficulty today, that even if people feel this sense of dissatisfaction with the status quo, they're not quite sure they know what the alternative program is. What does an alternative viable set of policies look like? And it might well be that we're just too... It's too soon to see what the alternative program will look like. You know, if you looked at, let's say, the 1930s, the aftermath of the crash of 29, it took about 15 or 16 years for people to sort out what the new world was going to look like. We didn't really get that right with regard to our notions about the welfare state and economic management until about the mid-1940s.